I'm kind of going on a mission, one golfer at a time, to try and get people to warm up effectively, because it can make a massive difference. So, you know, if you think you're going from a standing start to generating 70, 80, 90, maybe 100 miles an hour of clubhead speed, using pretty much every joint and every muscle in your body in less than a second, and you're not warming up to do that, and you expect to hit a lovely high 250-yard draw down the first tee, and you're not warming up, you're just saying, well, you're kind of asking for trouble. And how many people won't warm up and they'll think, oh, the first two or three holes is my warm up, by which time you've got a double bogey, a bogey, and your card's already looking a bit shaky.
Welcome to Golf Yourself Healthy, the community of golfers who are unified in their belief that golf is good for you. Welcome back to our regular listeners, the OGs. Welcome to any new listeners. So glad you can be here with us. Please do, if you'd like to join this community, follow us on your podcast platform of choice. That'll ensure that you're notified of new episodes as soon as they drop. We are available really on all the main major podcast platforms, so make sure to hit that follow button. My name is Chris Lynch. I am the host of the GYH podcast. Please join me and invited guests as we share stories around how golf is helping us to live happy, healthy, and fulfilled lives. This week's guest is Ed Voss. Ed is a GYH community member himself. He has been listening to the podcast since the very early stages of our launch. And really, I've just spoken a bit about the community. More specifically, the GYH community is not just a community of golfers who believe in the health and well-being benefits of golf, but what I want the GYH community to be and the members that sit within it are to be a group of people who support each other in golf, but on life's journey too. And I count Ed in that regard. Ed went to the trouble of travelling about an hour and a half, I guess, from his home in Stroud in Gloucestershire over to be with me in person in my home podcast studio here in Mid Wales. And really, as ever, as with any community, as with any conversation, things are always better in person. And I really truly cherished and loved this conversation. I think you will too, because there's so much to it. This is kind of a two-part conversation, I would say. For the first 40, 45 minutes or so of this conversation, it focuses on golf fitness, on golf physiotherapy, given that Ed himself is by profession a physiotherapist who runs two businesses, Ed Voss Physio and Swing Fit. The former being a core physiotherapy business where Ed works in across various sports and with various clients, golf just being one of them. He also works with runners and other sports too. But Swing Fit is more focused on golf fitness. So within part one of this conversation, it really focuses on golf fitness. And there's so many insightful and interesting things that Ed shares there that will help you golf yourselves healthy. In that soundbite that you just heard, wow, I couldn't really believe, well, I can believe the importance of warming up, but I'm not good at it. And we speak about that. I dare say that others of you out there listening will also relate to what Ed talks about in relation to, you know, a lot of us don't even bother warming up. We dismiss the importance or the value in doing it. Sometimes we're in a rush getting to that first tee, or we don't even want to make a fool out of ourselves and look a bit odd when we're doing various stretches next to the tee box in front of an audience. But the importance of warming up, the importance of golf fitness in general, what it is and why we should do it, the importance of personal accountability and consistency in our golf fitness, loads and loads of interesting points to cover there. The second part of this episode is more, I would say, a conversation with Ed sharing personally about his own journey in golf, who he is as a golfer, who his inspirations are in golf, as ever, reflecting nostalgically on family and friends' memories of golfing together. It's a really, really nice conversation. I really hope you enjoy it. Without any further ado, let's tee off and jump into it. Welcome, Ed, to the Golf Yourself Healthy podcast.
Thank you very much for having me. It's great to be here.
thank you for coming to the studio. You are the second guest we've had in the studio. So it's nice. It feels nice, warm and cozy. We're all set here with our cafetiere, and you are so it's funny because I guess, you know, I'm sure we'll touch on it, but the way I look back is our connection, how we kind of ended up here today, is at least in part because of you listening to that episode where I had Zach, the previous only other person to actually have come into the studio. So it's good to have you here, and I really appreciate and very grateful you've made the effort to travel this way to be here.
Okay.
Let's speak a bit about, I mean, we're just speaking, but for the benefit of the listener, you, before you got here this morning, were delivering a golf fitness class.
Yeah,
so
that's right.
Tell us what that involves.
So that involves, I've got a group of about 10 golfers now, and they're all probably 50 plus. You know, those people who are keen to play, they probably play a bit more because they're retired now, and they're keen to kind of keep themselves as fit as possible to get the most out of the game. So we usually cover kind of three areas. We do, after our warm-up, we do a little bit of strength work, then we go through some core work, and then we finish with a bit of mobility to finish. So all very golf specific. One of my previous roles was a Pilates instructor for 6 years. So I guess I draw a reasonable amount from the kind of what my modified version of Pilates, which was not particularly traditional. But no, it's a great class, really, really nice group of people, very social. It's just, yeah, it's a nice way to kick the week off, really.
Mm. And you're based where?
I'm in Stroud in Gloucestershire.
Okay. And is that where you host the class or?
Yeah, literally 100 yards from my front door, which is even better. Really convenient.
Happy days.
Yeah.
Happy days. Out of interest, I wanted to ask you, on this podcast, I'm really a big one for nostalgia. I reflect quite a lot on the COVID years, for instance, and how COVID was very devastating for many people. But for golf, for the game of golf, it actually was a shot in the arm. It got a lot of people into golf. And it makes me think about what that did for people going to online content, for instance, right? So everything was online during COVID.
Yeah.
All of my golf content that I would normally consume in person, if you will, or golf fitness, like anything golf related in relation to my swing, to my short game, to my fitness, whatever, everything was done online during COVID. But I look at a model like Peloton, for example. I've got a Peloton bike downstairs. I see how Peloton as a business are actually in a bit of trouble these days because they really banked on everyone going online and staying online even after COVID. But to what extent does physiotherapy, for instance, how effective is that delivered online versus in person?
Yeah, it's a good question because one we didn't really have to give much thought to until obviously COVID hit. So the clinics were all shut. We were only shut for about 2 months, so it wasn't too bad. It wasn't too long. But some of us pivoted pretty quickly to providing online appointments because it was something that was relatively new for most of the population. There was only, maybe my diary was about a third full compared to what it might be. There was, you know, not everyone thought they were going to get the benefit from online because people like to feel like they're having done something done to them. You know, they're having that physical hands-on treatment as part of their rehab. But actually, one thing it really improved with a lot of us who made that transition was improving our eye for movement and being able to observe what people are doing rather than just, you know, being able to do your strength testing and your manual therapy. Actually just taking a step back and getting somebody to do a toe touch, to do a squat, to do these movement patterns that we look at all day, every day, and actually just being able to hone our ability to observe what they're doing and start to theorize why they might be doing it. I think it also, from my point of view, meant that I put more credence and more emphasis on what somebody's history was. So why they might be doing what they're doing at that point in time. So you want to start gathering a really kind of clear picture of somebody's complete injury history and medical history and emotional, you know, and any emotional traumas that feed into it, rather than just relying on your ability to feel and to assess kind of in a hands-on way. Mm. Most people, once the clinics open back up again, you know, we had to put our procedures in place, but most people actually want to be seen in person, which is why maybe from an exercise point of view, you know, if these companies are starting to struggle a little bit now, because people like to speak to and deal with people, I think, for the large part. I think the online stuff is convenient, and if you're busy and you know you work from home and you want to do a quick 20-minute session, well, yeah, there's definitely a market for it. But I think generally with the classes, I like to see people and yeah. speak to people and deal with them face to face.
It's quite interesting because we'll use this as a segue in talking about your new business. Mm. Tell us about the new business venture you just got off the ground.
So the new one kind of is preceded by a slightly older one. So if we just very briefly knit back to the pandemic, what that made people realize in my industry was that there's a huge, great big market to be accessed online. And some people are doing it very successfully. And you mentioned Zach Gould earlier. Mm-hmm. And he's been providing, he was Dr. Golf before, and now Zach Gould Golf. You know, he's been doing a really, really good job. So during the first month or so of lockdown, and I was thinking, well, I'm not seeing any patients. I've not got any income. What can I do? So at that point, I produced a website with a good friend of mine, Dan, called SwingFit. And that was, again, golf-specific fitness, online, monthly subscription. So I produced this website. And I've put quite a lot of time and effort into that. But then what I realized was that there are other people out there doing the same thing who are probably better placed than me, because it was more of that, the strength and conditioning side of things. And someone like Zach is far better placed than me from a conditioning point of view. Mm. At the same time as trying to do that, I was launching my own physio business. So my physio career has gone kind of quite traditionally. I worked in the NHS, I hit a ceiling, I went to private practice, I've then hit another ceiling, and then I thought, right, well, the next step is to become a clinic owner. And I'm doing that in a very kind of grassrootsy type of way, I guess you'd say. I've converted my garage, I work at home, I'm trying to build a business literally from the ground up. So for the last 6 months, I've really been pushing a lot more in terms of learning about the marketing and advertising and how to find leads and to nurture them and to get my own business off the ground. And as part of that, then I've got these classes, one for golfers and actually another one for runners as well, to try and help people. You know, everyone likes doing the thing. Everyone likes getting out for a round of golf, but they don't necessarily like doing some of the slightly more boring stuff, the mobility work on a regular basis, or making sure they're strong so they're a little bit less injury prone perhaps. So I'm trying to give a space where, you know, people have that routine time. Monday morning, 9 o'clock, that's when I go and do my class with Ed. I've had that hour work to help my body get better for my chosen activity, and then they can, you know, make them a bit more resilient and a bit more robust on the golf course.
Okay.
So it's going well at the moment, but it's very, very early days.
So SwingFit is the name of the business?
Well, SwingFit is the name of the online golf fitness program.
Okay, fine.
My business is just very simply Ed Voss Physio.
Got it. Fine. Okay. And so with Ed Voss Physio, from what I'm just playing it back, so you're kind of looking at not just exclusively golf. You will, in terms of your clients, maybe someone that is a golfer and you're treating them in a potentially in a golf context, if you will, but you've got some runners, you've got, is that right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, quite a broad, beyond golf and running, have you got any other?
Yeah, I do. Yeah, absolutely. I think you have to, you know, I have to be a little bit more broader with my approach in the early stages, because at the end of the day, I've got to pay the bills. And, you know, I can't drill down on that very specific niche of golfers straight off the bat. Mm. The golfers are the people that I really like working with, because I love playing golf. I love chatting about golf all day. I love helping other people get the most out of their golf. So the golfers are the people that I really want to get to, and I'm learning how to access them. And actually it's going pretty well at the moment. But again, it's a process to go through. So in that, my other chosen activity that I have time for is I run regularly. So I run with a club as well. So again, I put a similar class on for runners, and that then feeds into the clinic. But as I get busier and I can be a little bit more selective with who I work with, It's definitely the golfers who I love working with.
I was going to ask you why. So yeah, say a bit more about that then. Why golf?
Why golf? So the main reason is that I'm a sports enthusiast. I'm an outdoor activity enthusiast. I'm an active guy, and golf is probably the one activity that I've done for longer than any other, and I will continue to do for longer than any other. What I love about it is that, you know, we were touching earlier, we spoke earlier before we started recording about the fact that I play a bit of five-a-side football, but there's a lifespan to that. At some point, my body's going to say, you shouldn't be doing this anymore. With golf, you know, I've got an 89-year-old patient who plays golf three times a week, and he walks it. and it keeps him fit and it keeps him active. He has the social connections with his mates. He's still got that little bit of competitive element. He's out in, you know, green space, which we know is great for mental health. So I think the reason I love golf and working with golfers is that you see a really broad spectrum of people, and it's something that people can keep doing and keep themselves active with for, as you know, for probably for longer than most other sports, maybe with the exception of lawn bowls and, you know, if you're a mountain walker or a hiker, that type of thing. But you lose that kind of competitive element. But yeah, it just gives us a nice level playing field right the way through until we're, you know, we're ready to stop playing, basically.
Mm-hmm. It may come across like a antagonistic question, but it's actually not. It's one driven by curiosity, which is, you know, if again, so you've got, you know, your established EdVos physio business, you're trying to grow Swing Fit at the moment, which is golf specific. Mm-hmm. So say a bit more about what that looks like. Kind of if someone signs up to be a customer of yours with Swing Fit, what do they get for that?
So at the moment, it's kind of done on either a monthly or an annual subscription. So whilst they've got access on the site, you've got a breakdown into three different sections. And this is roughly what I base my classes on, is that I want people to be stronger. I want people to be more mobile. And I want people to have better control of how they move. So you'll have a strength session, a core section, and a mobility section. And there's all golf, they're all driven to golf specific movements. So a lot of rotational work, a lot of work in terms of hip mobility, shoulder mobility, core work, again, a lot of rotation work. So we focus a lot on your oblique muscles as much as anything else. And then the strength work, again, is split into upper body, lower body. But that doesn't necessarily only give people benefits from a golfing perspective. You know, generally speaking, if from the age of 40, all of us are doing a little bit of resistance training, it's going to help us out in the longer term. And then within those sections, you can tailor it to be specific to the level that you can work at. So I'm not going to go and chuck somebody into doing a jump squat straight away, because a lot of people won't be able to do that. So you've got to be able to build the foundation. So what I hopefully give people the tools to do is to start at the right level for them. And then as they progress, then they can start pushing themselves to get stronger, more flexible, you know, push themselves so that they get the benefits out of the platform. Mm-hmm. But you know, you look at, you know, you'll see it all over social media, these you know, all the top guys and girls training and how much time they put in the gym and the work that they're doing, and you know, they're all athletes now. There's absolutely no reason why all of that can't be applicable to Joe, who's 65, who plays twice a week with his mates, who plays off 13, you know, If he was in better shape physically, it would improve him on the course. I'm not making any promises that by being fitter and stronger, you're necessarily going to improve your scoring, but you're going to feel better after a round, you're going to feel better post-round, you'll recover quicker. And actually just day to day, you're going to feel like golf is something that's much more within your grasp from a fitness point of view.
Mm-hmm. So do you have almost like a target customer range, either that and or do you see a certain demographic normally showing up at your door, if you know what I mean, in terms of wanting to be seen by you?
Yeah.
In golf,
yeah. Yeah, absolutely. In golf, it's going to be probably 50 plus.
Okay. And so what are they presenting to you as the issues that they're experiencing, or what are their goals? What are the things that you would typically expect to want to help them with?
Yeah. Okay. So the most common issue that we're seeing, and this is the same as the general population, is lower back issues. You know, again, it's the amount of force that goes through the lower back when you swing a golf club is massive. And, you know, it's often considered as a relatively gentle sport, golf. But when you, I always give the data, like, you know, if I run, roughly about three times worth of compressive force goes through my lower back when my foot hits the ground. When I swing my driver, it's 6 to 8 times my body weight worth of force, shearing force, that goes through my lower back. So we're dealing with really, really high forces. And it takes its toll on the body, and especially a body that, you know, is 40, 50, 60 plus, starting to degenerate below the surface. You know, it's a big demand. So we see a lot of lower back issues. with the older demographic knees as well, and especially from, you know, a rotational point of view, if I've got a mildly degenerative knee, the cartilage is getting a little bit thinner, a bit more irritable. If I twist my knee on a planted foot, it's going to be sore. So we see a lot of people with, you know, starting to struggle with their knees a little bit, and shoulders as well, we see a lot of. So those are probably the three main areas. And why people come in and see me? One, they would rather have less pain, if not no pain at all. I think no pain at all as we get probably push on a little bit in years is unrealistic. So it's just being able to educate people as to what's acceptable, what's not acceptable, what they need to pay attention to, what they just need to learn to manage. So they want to know about their pain and what they can do to best manage it. Then they want to know what they can do to reduce the pain.
Mm.
And that's usually a combination of some hands-on treatment, but in the longer term, getting them doing the right things on a regular basis habitually to look after themselves and to know what's the best thing I can do for this type of knee pain? What's the best thing I can do? Because, you know, there's so much information out there on Dr. Google that, you know, it's all generic. So I think it's really important to make sure you're specific for the individual. So they want to know what they can do. And then really, they want to be able to hit the ball further. Everyone wants to be able to hit the ball further, don't they? So, you know, giving people...
But how realistic does that become the older that you get?
I
almost wonder, like, how much you... I'm wondering how much you actively educate, if you do at all, your clients. Because much in the same way you were telling... You know, you alluded to guys, let's say, just talk about men for a second, will play five-a-side football or whatever, and that, you know, when they get to their 40s or beyond, like these sort of like your body can't respond to things in the way it used to before. Mm. Do you get where I'm going with this? Is it like, do you almost have to, or maybe not, maybe you can get strong in golf because that's what's so unique about golf?
Yeah, you've got to be realistic with your expectations. I think that's where a lot of people fall down, is that they set out with expectations that are completely unrealistic and they set themselves up to fail. This is why I talk about New Year's resolutions all the time. Like, I'm going to go to the gym like five times a week. I'm going to cut out booze from my diet. I'm going to eat really healthily. And you just kind of, you're not. That's too much to change. You're setting yourself up to be unrealistic with your expectations of what you're able to do. And it's the same with physio and with treatment. Like, you've got to be really, really clear from the outside. Like, this is what we are aiming for. This is what our target's going to be. And this is how long it's going to take. And most things, you know, if you're going to be successful in terms of building strength or improving your body physically, you know, it's a months and months process, and you have to turn up and do the work. So there's got to be that education right from the outset of people's realistic, people's expectations, and you've got to be realistic. And if they don't want to put the time and the effort in, that's fine. They can go and look for a quick fix. But I'm more interested in long term. I always say to patients, I'm much more interested in the long term outcome here. Mm. I can do some manual therapy and someone can walk out the room feeling less pain when they walk out, but it's short term. I want to know that when they walk in next time and the next time and the next time, that they still feel that improvement. And then you can kind of recalibrate your goals. You know, okay, first goal, you want to be less pain. Right, let's tick that off. Right, what's the next goal? What do you want to be able to do? Right, now I want to go from playing two rounds a week to three rounds a week, and I want to do an hour on the range on a Friday evening. So I say, right, well, now you need to be more robust in order to tolerate that increase in load. And that means you need to be stronger and better able to deal with what you're asking your body to do.
Mm-hmm. Would I be right in saying then that with the two businesses we've been talking about, Edvos Physio and Swing Fit, you've got one which is, well, I was going to almost say more like the traditional physiotherapy where, because keep me honest here and educate me here, Ed, because when I think of physiotherapy and my own first-hand experience of it, I'm going to a physio typically reactively rather than proactively.
Yeah.
Is that a general way in which people engage with physiotherapy? Because something's happened.
Because something's happened, something's sore, it's stopping them doing what they want to do. Right, this has gone on for long enough, what can I do about it?
So that's Edvos Physio, say, for example, from a business model perspective, if you will.
Yeah.
In simple terms, right? And then you've got Swing Fit, which is more like the proactive kind of, right?
Yeah.
And fitness,
yeah,
that'd
be fair.
Specific to golf. So how do you, because again, my own personal experience is, you know, I can be cynical at the best of times, but I get very cynical whenever I experience quite a bit of lower back pain, have done for different reasons for many years. I think being quite tall, I grew up I always remember from a young age getting a lot of sort of lower back pains or sort of growing pains or whatever it was, but it's kind of carried with me until the tender age of 38. But whenever I go to a doctor, say, and present with back pain, and where they say, oh, right, go and see a physio, I'm like, oh, I don't want to have to do that, because I always want them to have the silver bullet.
Yep.
And I can't expect a physio to have that. And I think the thing that I struggle with, and I wonder how you see this with some of your patients, is at the end of the day, it requires them to put some work in based on what you're giving them mm-hmm. to see the results.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like this no is the, pain, no gain, essentially, for to coin a phrase, you know. It's,
yeah. This is something that physios have to work hard to get good at and to be able to get better results with, is that it's adherence from their patients. Look, it's not, there's nothing that any one person can do passively to you that will solve your back pain. There are too many variables. There's too many facets that will contribute to that back pain. The first thing we need to try and, you know, you need to establish, and this is where in the difference between someone who will just treat your symptoms and someone who will treat the whole, is that you've got to try and work out what's driving that back pain. Why is the back painful? And often the back isn't the problem. Often the back is getting battered because something else isn't doing its job properly, or something can't load well, or something can't move well. Your brain is unbelievably good at finding solutions. It's, you know, if you've had pain or surgery or trauma or an injury, when that issue is in the system, the brain will find a solution, it will find a way around it. But what it isn't very good at doing is undoing the changes it makes when things settle down. So let's say, for example, you know, when you were 17, you tore your hamstring, your brain found a solution at the time, the hamstring healed, but you were left with a slightly deficient system where you couldn't load all that well through that left leg. If you can't load well through that left leg, that load is still going to be dealt with somewhere when you swing a golf club. But it may be that your brain is saying, right, we're going to shunt it up into the lower back. So the lower back saying to the brain, well, I can't cope with what you're asking me to do here. This is too much load. And it gets painful. So you then go and see a physio. They say, right, let's do a bit of manual therapy on your lower back, treat the symptoms. Here are some exercises for your lower back. But if that left leg doesn't get dealt with and doesn't get picked up, you just go round in circles. So you've got to look at the bigger picture. You've got to look at the detailed injury history. You've got to look at how somebody moves from the ground up, or if it's upper body, from the hands in, to see why that back is getting painful in the first place. And then you've got to take into consideration lifestyle. Do you sit on your backside at a desk 8 hours a day? Are you driving in and out of London all the time? Are you immobile? Are you not doing any exercise? Is your diet poor? You know, there are all of these other facets that have to be looked at. And then you've got to convince the patient, like, this is the problem. And these are the things that we can do to help it. Yeah, some things I can do to you to help in the early stages. Other things you're going to do. And then you've got to try and make it as manageable as possible. Because if I give you a list of probably any more than four things to work on, you're not doing it. It just doesn't get done. Like, people are too busy. You might be able to find 5 minutes, but there's no way you can find 20 minutes a day. I couldn't. I just haven't got the capacity between work and family and fun that, you know, it just doesn't happen. So, you know, I'm very limited in terms of what I ask people to do. I'll give them three, maybe four a push things to do. And you've got to then try and find a way of making it as unobtrusive on their day-to-day as possible.
Mm.
And if you can do that, if you can find that window in that person's day and incorporate what you're asking them to do so that it becomes habitual, they will start to see the improvements. And when they see the improvements, they'll think, oh, bloody hell, this is working. And then they'll get the motivation to progress and to keep working on it.
So the reason I'm going to hold this up for a second so that people can, that's actually not a good thing. There is a kettlebell here, and there's a reason more than it just being a table weight. The reason, Ed, that kettlebell is there is because not that exact one, but a 20 kg one was the culprit. I was probably the culprit, but let's say the 20 kg kettlebell was the culprit the other day when I was trying to do a squat and my back just pinged. So given what I've just told you, what would you say back to me in relation to, like, how would you help me diagnose what's happened there?
I'd ask you what your entire injury history is. So I'd know what could potentially be contributing to how your back's behaving at the moment. I'd want to know how you move. So I'd want to see if there are any deficits in terms of how you load. Then I would want to do a physical assessment to see how you're dealing with load all through the body in all the different planes of movement. And then it may just be a matter of, you know, either is your technique poor, are your loading mechanics not right, or have you just asked your back or your body to lift something heavier than it's happy to lift? And that's the other thing, that the body's got a mechanical limit, and every now and again we find it, and the result is usually something getting painful.
So I think, yeah, what happened in that example was, you know, it's interesting because, you know, again, we kind of got connected, let's just say, through you listening, I think, to the Zach Gould episode. I know you'd maybe been listening to the podcast before that, but it was the thing that prompted you to get in touch. I've been working with him, doing a kind of a fitness plan through him. I've been terrible in relation to my commitment to it, which is notorious of me. And so just the other day, I was like, do you know what? Actually, I think I know what I'm doing. I like kettlebells. I'm just going to make up my own kind of class, because I know various different kettlebell movements. And I'm just going to go, like, because I think I know I can take 20 kg when it's in squatting. Mm-hmm. But I don't know, it just felt like that day I hadn't warmed up properly. I still felt stiff in my back. And I think my form maybe wasn't so great, because I was like almost like holding it in a way which is, so the way Zach taught it, which definitely helps, is like actually holding it by its handles and going down and up vertically.
Yeah.
But what I decided to do, just because I thought, hey, I'm going to mix things up here,
yeah,
was like hold it in towards me, the handle, and like go like up and then something. Yeah. So, I mean, I don't know. I mean, there's probably no point in me even trying to diagnose what happened there, but I think it's almost a lesson in, because what I'm hearing and what you just said to me is, just know your limitations. Don't take matters into your own hands sometimes as well.
Sometimes, yeah.
Yeah.
But I think it's what's commendable is that you know, there was that proactivity, right? Come on, I've not done anything for a little while. Now I need to get my act together and actually do something. But that irregularity often will open you up to causing problems. You know, especially from a strengthening point of view, strength comes with consistency. You've got to turn up and do the work regularly over a period of time to see the benefits. And then you've got to stick with it. And we detrain so much quicker than we improve when we train. So you might have done exercises for a month. You're like, right, yeah, brilliant. And we've got the bit between our teeth. If you then have 3 weeks off, you're kind of back to square one. But if you pick up where you left off at week four and you're doing more than the body can tolerate, then again, the body's going to get overloaded and get annoyed with that. Then you think, okay, technique-wise, if you're here, everything's nice and close in. If I turn it like that and I've got more of a weight out in front and more of a lever, well, I've got to work harder at my back to counteract the fact that that weight is now slightly further out in front of me. I thought you were going to say you had the weight out in front, so you were really long lever. You know, if I lift close in, I'm much easier than I'm lifting away. But even a slight change of this to this is going to change the load as to what's going on at the back.
Yeah, I'm so glad I asked you that question, because that's really enlightening, actually, because, yeah, I mean, I felt it. Like, it was awkward.
Mm.
It felt like a real difference. I mean, there is physically a difference in the way that I'm holding it, but what you said there about how we detrain quicker than we build up strength or muscle, is there almost like a stat that goes with that? Like in relation to the acceleration, deceleration of, because that's almost blown my mind. I mean, I feel like I should know that and that makes a lot of sense, but.
I mean, the roughly speaking, the data that I've seen is that it takes about 3 times longer to get it back than it does to lose it in the first place.
No way.
But actually, look, you'd have to let me go away and find the reference for that. But it takes, from a strengthening point of view, and this is where we struggle in the physio world, is that you're always, in 99% of cases, you're always going to get given exercises by a physio. You need to make sure they're the right ones, but you're always going to get given things to do. And people will do them for maybe 3 or 4 weeks and they'll think, oh, do you know what? This isn't making any difference. I don't feel like my elbow's getting less painful or my knee's feeling better.
Mm.
Because the body needs that time to adapt. So you get a lot of drop off because you're like, well, you know, not making any difference. I've done my exercises for a month. I'm no better. This doesn't work for me. And it won't, because the body needs that regular input consistently over a long period of time. We're talking months for you to really reap the rewards and the benefits. Mm-hmm. Like I say, if you then all of a sudden stop for 3 or 4 weeks, you then need to reflect that in where you pick back up. But it does take, like I say, time to get that strength in the first place and a lot less time to then lose it.
I think there's three things I'm taking away from that, and tell me if any of these sound incorrect, but one is consistency.
Correct.
Is so critical.
Yes.
Two is almost take your medicine, in so much as if, as has been the case for me, there are gaps between my training, don't go straight in at a 20 kg, even though you know that when you're strong and you've been consistent, you can take it. Mm-hmm. I'd had a break, so I'd maybe drop it down.
Yeah.
Drop it down to a 16 or a 12 or something like that.
Ease yourself back into
it. And then maybe thirdly, and this is for me personally, keep your ego in check as well. Mm-hmm. I think something I see a lot in golf is you compare yourself to that person who has this handicap, this swing, and that does not serve you.
Yeah,
you know?
Absolutely.
And I, in my own mind, was telling myself, you can do this. Mm-hmm. You should be able to do this because of a man of your stature or whatever, right?
Yeah. And that's you against yourself. Mm. So many people, especially like in the class situation or in the gym, class is a classic one. People will come in and say, oh, do you know what? I was looking around the room and that person could move much, or that person could lift a bigger weight than me. And that, and you're like, doesn't matter what anybody else in that room is doing, because you don't know what their history is. You don't know what their injuries are. You don't know what their situation is. It doesn't matter what anybody else can do. This is about what you can do. And like I say, if you then start comparing yourself to others and getting competitive about it, then you're going to think, yeah, right, no, he's lifting the 20 kg, I can do a 20 kg. And if you haven't trained yourself to be able to lift a 20 kg, then your body's going to probably be unhappy about it.
Yeah,
I think with exercise, and this is something I say to patients all day, every day, exercise, in the same way as medication, is about dosage. If you don't get the dosage right, there will be issues. If you don't do enough of it, you won't get the benefits. If you do too much of it, the body's not going to be grateful for it. So you have to get the dosage right. And that's what, you know, my role is really, I'm not a fixer, I'm a guide. And I said, this is what I think is going on, and this is why I think it's going on. This is what you need to be doing at this level. And then we progress and progress and progress. And if we have a flare up and we regress, we've got to take our medicine and escape, work out why, and then go again. But my job is just to guide. These are the things you need to do. This is the dosage you need to do it at. You need to now go and do the work.
Love it. Great analogy. Let's, before we transition off and into talking about Ed Voss, the golfer, anything more you wanted to, any sort of golden nuggets, if you like, that you would want the GYH community to know in relation to your golf fitness?
I think an important thing, and especially as we do get a little bit older, is that an expectation that your body is pain-free is unrealistic. That the body is an unbelievably complex bit of kit with a huge number of moving parts, all these interacting systems, and it doesn't take a lot to throw it out of kilter. But look, some pain is kind of to be expected, but you need to know which pain and how you best manage it. If you've got something going on that you know, in the back of your head, you're thinking, yeah, this doesn't feel right. Or, you know, a lot of people say, oh, it's been going on for 3 months and it just isn't getting better. You need to get it checked out. You need to go and see somebody and try and work it out rather than generically onto Google, I've got a nerve pain in my leg. It doesn't tell you why, and it will give you potentially the wrong things to do. So if you've got pain that you're not happy about, get it checked out, do the right things to get on top of it and have that guidance. And then you can start to get to grips with, okay, yeah, a little bit of low back pain post-round. That's just because it's a bit stiffer than it used to be. That's fine. But yeah, it's just having that bit of understanding.
Well, actually, it's funny because hopefully weather-dependent, which you just never know in mid-Wales what you're going to get any time of the year. But if the rain stays off, Ed and I are going to go out and play 9 holes after this, hopefully. But given what I've just told you about my back in the last couple of days, it's a little bit tender. I feel it's okay at the moment. My inclination is to go, sod it, let's just go out and play. Am I crazy for doing that?
Are you going to warm up before you play? Do you ever warm up before you play?
I have started doing it more now since working with Zach Gould,
yeah,
for instance. And I put that at least in part down to the just the very appreciation of the importance of a warm-up, right? And actually, I feel more mentally prepared. I feel more physically prepared when I warm up in golf these days. But if I'm honest, it's even then it's quite cursory. It's like a few, like he'll maybe give me like 8 exercises to do of a warm up. I'll only do 2 or 3 of them. So short answer is sort of.
All right. Well, I think
a little bit.
Like I said, it depends on what's acceptable from your point of view. We were touched on football earlier. Like, I still play a bit of five-a-side on a Monday. And last Monday, I stacked it and I've cracked a rib on my right-hand side. I'm still going to play because there's not, other than complaining about it to my wife, there's not a lot I can do about that rib. And actually, within the golf plane, the golf swing, that isn't a problem. If we were going out and chucking a ball around, then I wouldn't do it because it's bloody painful.
Mm-hmm.
But that, I know what's going on. I know what's acceptable. I know it's not going to make it worse. So I'm super keen to go and hit a few golf balls. But if you've got, you know, searing pain that's saying to you, please don't do that, you listen to it and probably not. I think with a bit of a niggly back, I think we'll get you warmed up and I think you'd be right.
Brilliant. Good. I certainly hope so. No, it's interesting because I'm curious as well about how you were saying a few minutes ago about that kind of increased load on your back in golf.
Mm-hmm.
And that makes me think about how when I play golf, when I'm carrying a niggling back injury, which has been on and off the case for me now for a number of months, at sometimes more than others, it weighs on my mind.
Mm-hmm.
And when it weighs on my mind, what happens? I pull out of a certain swing.
Yeah.
Or I'll be, yeah. And then what happens? I'll duff a shot.
Yep.
And then what happens?
Mm-hmm.
Get pissed off at myself. And then what, right? So I almost wonder if there's a, it sounds like a judgment call you have to make as an individual.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
But ultimately, a solid warm up is all, especially in a scenario where you're carrying maybe a niggling injury.
Yeah.
It would be kamikaze almost to, if you're going to make that call to go out and play when you've got a niggling injury and not do any warm, those are the times. Warm-ups are important always, but it sounds like they'll really serve you especially well when you're, is that fair?
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm kind of going on a mission, one golfer at a time, to try and get people to warm up effectively because it can make a massive difference. So, you know, if you think you're going from a standing start to generating 70, 80, 90, maybe 100 miles an hour of clubhead speed using pretty much every joint and every muscle in your body in less than a second, and you're not warming up to do that, and you expect to hit a lovely high 250-yard draw down the first tee, and you're not warming up, you just think, well, you're kind of asking for trouble. And how many people won't warm up and they'll think, oh, the first 2 or 3 holes is my warm up, by which time you've got a double bogey, a bogey, and your card's already looking a bit shaky. Whereas if you can put yourself physically in position and to prepare yourself for it, and I do, I'll show you later on the golf course, I do a resistance band warm up just to get muscles firing, just to kind of get my head in the game as well, but to get myself physically prepared for that amount of movement.
Mm-hmm.
The research as well tells us that it makes massive improvements. It improves centeredness of strike. It can improve your carry. It improves your club head speed. But there's almost like a stigma about doing a pre-golf warm-up. Like I said, the one I do with my bands, I look ridiculous. It looks odd on a golf course. But one of my ladies today, she's like, I went and did a talk at the golf club a few months ago. She's like, I still do my banded exercise. It makes me feel so much better down the first. I'm getting some funny looks, but you know what? I don't care. And I was like, brilliant. You shouldn't care. It doesn't matter what anybody else thinks. If this is helping you and you're feeling like you're better prepared physically and mentally, why would you not do it?
Yeah. And actually, like you say, who cares what other people think? But even if you and or someone else thinks that you look like a plonker, your scorecard will look great.
Exactly. Exactly. And what golfers care about?
And then who's laughing at the end?
Exactly. Yeah.
So, yeah, say a bit more about your golf then. How'd you get into it?
So I've been playing golf since I was 10, so about 30 years now. And my dad was a keen golfer. So I'm the youngest of 4 boys. And the other 3, I think, played a little bit, but I was the only one that showed a real interest in it. So we used to go up We lived on the back of, just off the edge of the Amberley Common, where the golf club I'm still a member of is situated.
Which is?
Minchinhampton Old Course. And so we'd go up in an evening, and like when the course was, because it's public land, we'd go up to the, like the sixth tee, which was the closest one to us. And he'd take me around, you know, three or four holes as a little loop in the evening. So he got me into that when I was about 10. And then I joined the new course, Minchinhampton New Course. So we've got the old course on the common, and you've got the new course, which has got two 18s and costs a hell of a lot more money. But lovely, lovely course. Great membership. Really, really nice place. And there's...
So they're different?
They're part of the same club.
Old and new?
Old and new, but... If you're
different membership tiers,
Yeah. So I'm a member of the old course because it's just more affordable for where I am in life right now, and I'm not getting a chance to play much golf.
Okay.
But through that, I get to at certain times access the new course, which is great. So every now and again, I'll go and have 9 holes or 18 at the new course through that membership, but only at certain times. But as a junior, you know, it's an absolute steal. My dad was a member at the new course, so I was then a member at the new course. And I was one of those kids who, you know, summer holidays, get dropped up there in the morning, get on the range. I had a couple of lads that I played with all the time and was super keen, super keen.
That, 'cause I know, like you were saying, we've both got some mutual connections through Cleve Hill Golf Club, for example, which is also very close, I would imagine, to where Minch is. Yeah. You're right. And I've been told, and I think you've told me as well, that it's got like, has it not got the biggest membership in the UK?
I think it's got one of, if not the biggest membership
in
the UK.
What drives that, do you think? Why is that?
I think having two 18s is a big factor because it means that you, there's nowhere else that has two 18s in locally that I can think of.
Right.
And having a two ball course and a three and a four ball course is great. One, it increases the capacity. So if you've got two courses, you can get more people on course at the same time. Mm-hmm. And therefore you can have a bigger membership physically. But it also takes away, you know, if you're a two ball and you're getting stuck behind a four ball, it takes away that slow play. So if you know there's a two ball course and there's only two of you, I just think it's more attractive. So I think having the two lots of 18 is a definite draw.
Okay.
And it's got the biggest women's section in the country. Again, I think the two courses will feed into that, but the women's section up there is absolutely amazing. I think it's 250 strong. They've got strong teams up there, really, really well attended events, but they do a really good job of bringing people in, I think.
So through your dad, you got an introduction to golf.
Yeah.
Tell us more about your dad then.
So my dad was a GP in Stroud. And he was a keen, very keen golfer. He played off, I think he got down to 8 was his best handicap, which means my life objective is to get to 7. But a very keen golfer. And
how's that going so far?
I'm down to 11. And I'm playing, not far, but I'm just not playing enough to get down there. But I will. I'm pretty determined.
Good.
But he was a very well thought of GP locally, very well known, quite kind of active. He was, you know, part of the parent governors at school, very involved in the medical scene locally, but obviously a keen golfer as well and quite a big rugby fan. And he was doctor at Gloucester Rugby Club for a couple of years. So he was quite well known, but keen golfer. And he was, obviously influential. I think he was delighted that one of his four sons showed a interest in following suit in the golfing side of it, as well as the medical side. I think I was always quite interested in what he did work-wise. And I think if it hadn't been for him, so he passed away in 1996 when I was 13. And I think if it hadn't been for that, I probably would have ended up doing medicine and following in his footsteps. But for one reason or another, I kind of went down the route I did, and I'm really pleased I did. But he was obviously hugely influential in terms of getting me into the game. And it's one of the reasons I think I probably stick with it now as well.
Because when you contacted me through the Golf Yourself Healthy website some time ago now, I was very touched about, well, first and foremost, that you did that, that you took the time to get in touch and share what this podcast has meant to you. But secondly, you shared about how, if I understood you right, golf has, in more recent times, through playing golf and being around people that your dad knew, has helped you get to know your dad better. So say a bit more about that.
Yeah, so I think over the last maybe 5 years or so, I've become really aware that having lost him when I was 13, I felt I never really knew him as what kind of bloke he was, what kind of friend he was, what he was like as a colleague. So I've been speaking to lots of different people about asking stories about him. I think it started off as a chance meeting with a chap who came to see me as a patient. Didn't know who I was. I didn't know who he was. And he came in, as lots of people do, because I still work locally where I grew up. And he said, "Voss, that's an unusual name. You're not a relation of Dr. Voss, are you?" I was like, "Yeah, that was my dad. I'm his youngest boy." And it turned out this chap was a guy that he played golf with in 83 and 84 when he won a particular competition at Minchinhampton. His name's up on the board now. And they weren't particularly friends, but this chap, his partner had let him down. And someone had said, "Oh, Graham Voss is looking for a partner for it. Why don't you ask him?" And they started playing together in this competition and they won it 2 years on the bounce. So I thought, actually, you know, and I chatted to him briefly. I only saw him a couple of times. So I started chatting to him and kind of just scratched the surface a little bit. And I thought, actually, you know, I think sometimes previously I'd felt awkward about asking my mum or asking people that knew him to tell me about him. I don't know what it was about that, but I still sometimes feel like maybe we don't ask, you know, what was he like when he was alive, in case you bring up negative memories and you upset somebody. But actually, people are quite happy to talk, I've found. So I thought, you know, there's a few people who I still know, mainly GPs locally, who all still play golf. And I've been out for 18 holes with a few of them. And I've used it specifically to ask them, you know, what was he like to work with? Tell me some stories about him. How was he on the golf course? You know, was he competitive? Was he petulant like I used to be? You know, I just wanted to feel like I got to know him as a person. And actually being on the golf course again, you've got 4 hours, you chat to people, you've got the space to actually ask questions. And whilst they go off and hit their shot, they might think of something else. So it's been a really, a really interesting process to go through. And I feel like I've gotten to know what he was like as a bloke a lot more than I ever had done previously.
Through the things that you've learned about him then, do you see, from a golfing perspective, are you like your dad as a golfer in any ways?
Yeah. Well, I think as the youngest of four, I was always unbelievably competitive growing up. And I have, some people might disagree with this, I think I've mellowed a little bit as I've got older. But, you know, he was driven, he was keen, and he wanted to win. You know, I think we play these sports because we want to beat our mates, don't we? We want bragging rights. And from what they say, you know, yeah, he was gracious in defeat, but he wanted to win.
Mm. Have you got an abiding memory with him from those early years of playing golf together?
So I've been thinking about this a lot. It was 27 years ago that he passed away. So the sad thing is my memories are quite distant. So, but I was thinking about this actually on the drive on the way down. There are two things that stand out for me on the golf course. One, the first shot I remember playing when I was playing with him was a putt on the 18th. And we were playing him and me against his eccentric French friend, Jean-Marie.
At Minchinhampton New Course.
On the Charrington. It was on the Charrington. So there's a Charrington in the evening. We were on the Charrington, which was the newer course. We were playing with Jean-Marie and his son, Seb, who was about 8 years older than me. He was a good friend of my brother's. And the only thing I remember was on the 18th, I made, I think, what must have been one of my first ever pars. And I sunk about, in my head, it was about a 12-foot putt on the 18th to win the game. And that was, I think that's my first golfing shot memory with him. In fact, full stop. So that one always stands out. And the second thing I was thinking about on the drive down here, I think when someone's passed away, you can sometimes forget what they sound like. You know, I've forgotten the sound of his voice. But I was listening to one of your podcasts actually, and they were talking about the women's game and how it's more about tempo rather than just a hammer the ball. And one thing he always taught me is like, it's all about timing. Don't try and hit the skin off the ball. It's all about timing. And every time he was like, up 2-3, down 2-3, up 2-3, down 2-3. And I remember, I was like, I can hear him saying it because he said it to me so many times. It's like, it's all about timing, up 2-3, down 2-3. And I can hear him saying that. And I'd like to say it serves me well. And it does for about the first 9 holes, unless I'm playing. And then if I'm playing well, I think, right, I'm going to really hit this ball hard. And I end up topping it 20 yards. But yeah, that timing is one thing that's always stood with me.
That's really nice. It's a really nice story. Thank you for sharing it. I feel like you've told your Eagle Has Landed story there now as well, Ed. You know, you've listened to the podcast, but you know the Eagle Has Landed.
I do know the Eagle Has Landed, yeah.
Is there another story beyond the one that you just told that you would like to share?
I had three in my head. That was one of them. Can I tell the other two?
Of course you can.
So the second one was, I went and lived in New Zealand for a year. And not long before that, I played a competition up at Minchinhampton and I shot 100 and I was awful, absolutely awful. And I vowed never to play a competition again. Couldn't stand it. I was just like, I don't want to put myself in that position again. And then when I was living in New Zealand, I joined Queenstown Golf Club, which if you haven't seen, just go and Google what it looks like. It's stunning. Absolutely amazing. Out on the peninsula in Lake Wakatipu, mountains behind it, just unbelievable. And when we were out there, a buddy of mine, Mark, who I played golf with, we went and played at a different resort, Millbrook, in like its competition. And I thought, oh God, this is going to be terrible. Stood up on the first tee, playing with a couple of old boys who had never met before, three iron in hand, because I didn't hit a driver back then. And I snap hooked it about 30 yards into the water. And I was just like, oh, this is not going to go well. All those memories came flooding back. And then second shot, obviously reloaded on that first tee. Second shot, hit a really nice shot down the fairway. Ended up with 41 points. One of the best rounds I've ever played in my life. And I was like, look, even if you get off to a shocking start, it doesn't necessarily mean the whole round is going to be that. So I always remember that shot. And then the last one, this is where I think I started mellowing in my competitiveness. I went on this funny golf trip a couple of years ago, like 5 or 6 years ago. There's meant to be four of us going to Portugal. This is my only ever golf trip. Meant to be four of us going. Two of them pulled out the night before we went. So I went on this trip with my friend Ross, who I've played a lot of golf with. But it was a bit peculiar going on a golf trip, just the two of you. But anyway, we played the second round, the beautiful course. I think I must have been four up with six to play. And then he won, pulled it back to three. And then it was the signature hole, which was the 15th par three on the ocean, 200 yards, tough green, bunker back right, big slope, just next to where the pin was on the right-hand side. And he hit just the most perfect four iron. Absolutely unbelievable shot. And I remember that shot probably more than I remember any of the shots I've ever hit. And I was just like, fair play, mate. That is unbelievable. And he won that hole, pulled it back to two, and then my head was gone. And he ended up beating me on the 18th. So he pulled it back from four down, six to play, and he beat me by one. But actually, it was one of those where I thought, do you know what? I'm in Portugal. I'm having a nice time. He's just played out of his skin on that last six to beat me. I felt like that was the point where my competitiveness just started to wane a little bit.
Yeah, that sounds like a story where at the end of the day, you kind of reflected, well, he won it rather than me losing it, maybe.
Yeah.
Like, you know, he just really pulled it out of the bag.
He did. I think I probably capitulated a little bit on the last couple of holes, but he'd put me in that position where he'd put the pressure on with some great golf.
Yeah.
I was just like, yeah, I can't do anything about that. If you're going to play shots like that, then hats off to you. You deserve to win.
Yeah. Fair enough. No, great stories. Love it. We'll round it off with Cut It Out. If you could remove anything from golf that grinds your gears a wee bit, what would it be?
I think maybe some of the older generation. And it is more the older generation, the younger. It's a bit of a generalization, but it generally is those guys.
See it as you see it, Ed.
Yeah.
See, as you've experienced it,
who will call people out on the golf course for really petty things, and you just think that just you don't know what's going on with these people. You know, if they're not doing any harm, you don't have to call them out on, or you didn't repair that pitch mark, or why you shouldn't be wearing those socks with those shorts. You know, I just think there's a little bit of this kind of old school seriousness that could come out of golf for me. I played around a couple of years ago with a teaching pro who hit the ball a mile, absolute mile. So we were waiting. He'd spoken to the pro. He was waiting on the pro's tees, which me and my buddy weren't playing. He was. And these four guys came up from behind us. Oh, you shouldn't be playing off that tee. What are you doing off that tee? Blah, blah, blah. Well, why don't you hit your shot? They're out of range. But the lads was like, no, actually, look, I'm a teaching professional. I can hit the ball 350 yards. That's why I'm on this tee. And he proceeded to hit an absolute monster drive way over the, like most people would have laid up over the water.
Yeah,
he
yeah.
just creamed it. And I just thought of these guys as like, why are you getting so angry? You don't know that he's not a pro. That's why he's off those tees. You didn't need to come and get your words in and, you know, have a go at people, you just don't know. And it happens too much on the golf course. And I think we want to be welcoming people into games, especially juniors. You know, if a junior came across a guy like that, that's going to turn them off wanting to go out on the golf course, isn't it? They want to be encouraging more people into the game, and especially younger guys and girls as well. I just think people need to calm down a little bit.
Yeah, it's an interesting one, right? Because I think we've spoken about this sort of subject on the podcast in recent times. And yeah, I think unfortunately, you know, speaking from experience, it has been my experience as well, that it tends to be that kind of older generation of golfer who will, it's more common really than it is in sort of maybe just the younger generations coming through to be just like that, just to, and I guess what I'm hopeful of is that, you know, again, as we're living through times where it's becoming more commonplace for men, especially, to be more in touch with their feelings and seek help for things, seek therapy for things, be more appreciative and understanding of other people beyond just themselves, that the future is hopefully brighter in relation to, because again, I think, you know, anyone that listens to this podcast on the regular, or anyone that's listening to it new as well, will hopefully know just and appreciate by the way in which we're putting this across that there's no intention here at all to throw shade at anyone. It's kind of coming from a place of, actually, it's kind of the way, what I'm hearing is the actions of, or the behaviors of, or the words that are uttered by anyone, whether you're an older generation or otherwise, are having an impact on certain people in the way that it's making them feel in relation to their experience out on the golf course, which, if that, you know, has the potential to result in someone not feeling welcome or not ever wanting to come back again, then that is not a good thing.
No, absolutely,
that's not a good
not.
Thing for anyone, not for your golf club. And I think my experience has been with, you know, for instance, having served on a board at a golf club for a while, is trying to, a way in which, you know, it can work well when you try and put a point across to someone, especially someone who's really belligerent in their own view, is think about this through the lens of what's good for your golf club, for example.
Yeah.
You know, because if you care so much about the prosperity of and the future of your golf club, then, you know.
I think I remember you talking early on about you taking someone to the club who was doing an article.
Oh, it was Alex, Elevation Golf Nation.
And obviously the guys were having a bit of a go at you.
Yeah.
And you think, well, you don't know that he's now in that article going to write something scathing about how unwelcoming this club is and how a negative impact that might have on the club.
Yeah,
potentially. So you just, I just think if you've got an issue, fine. But just, I think there's a kinder way and a calmer way to go about resolving these things on the golf course. Whereas I find that because it's a bloody frustrating sport, people's kind of irritation from their own game is probably creeping up if they're having a really shocking round, and then something happens with that group in front of them, or then a ball comes a bit too close to them, and they just snap.
Yeah.
You know, and I think there's that to take into consideration as well on the golf course, because it's quite a uniquely frustrating sport and quite a can be a very frustrating environment. And sometimes it doesn't take too much to trigger. But like I said, you need to then think about what reaction or what consequences that's going to have for the person that you're triggering at. You know, they might have not done anything too bad, but because of the reaction that you've had, it has quite profound consequences.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, most definitely.
But that can be said of the, you know, of life in general.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, I think the other thing you made me think about here is it's a lot of this boils down to self-awareness with people, I think. And the more that someone can work on their ability to recognize where actually they may have said or done something which is they're in the wrong, actually, is a really healthy practice. Like, I mean, I just give an example of this. Like, just before you got here, I walked the dogs. I've not heard a peep out of them, which is great, because normally they do, they're down in the kitchen behaving themselves well. But I take them for a walk. There's like a kennels just up the road from our house here, where our podcast studio is. And there's like the guy who owns the kennels there, like when one of my dogs was really young and his recall wasn't great, Like, he's walking some of his dogs, that he's, you know, his customers' dogs from the kennels. My dog runs off towards them and he's like, could you get your dog in a lead, please? He was totally right, but I kicked off at him, you know, and actually I took the it was confrontational, and I then realized, well, he is in the right there. And then the next time I saw him a few days later, I went over to him and said, Tony, I'm sorry. That was my bad, actually, you know. And I think, again, if you can work on your ability to do that and defuse a situation, then again, I think you can reverse some of the damage you've maybe actually done as well. Like in the example you gave there with that guy, like he came up to us, kicked off about slow play, but it really wasn't our fault. Like we were like bunged up on the golf course and like, you know, and when we presented that to him, he doubled down, you know, so it's a
did
funny
he, one. Did he come and find you at the end to say...
His playing partner did.
Yeah.
And so, and actually, so again, that was the saving grace. So fair play to that guy for, but anyway. So I think, Ed, we can round things off there. I think you've enlightened me in many different ways in this conversation. I'm sure you will have done the same for the GYH listener as well. So,
I hope so.
Thank you very much for coming across. And
it's not raining.
It's not raining. So I think green light.
Let's go and get a few holes in.
Let's do it.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for coming. Cheers, Ed. I hope you enjoyed today's episode. Do remember to follow us on your podcast platform of choice. If you'd like to get in touch with the show, with me directly, you can email me. Email address is listed in the show notes. Or if you listen on Spotify, for example, you can use the comments feature there to drop in a few words about what you liked about this episode, the show in general, and any feedback or ideas for future episodes. But until the next time, please always remember to embrace the rough and forever cherish the fairway.